Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, welcome to Brain Injury Radio Network. Tonight is our regular Wednesday installment of our program Recovery Now with your host, Kim Justice. If you'd like to know more about my story, you can find it at inaflash.org. I, too, am a fellow traumatic brain injury survivor. I appreciate you tuning in tonight, and as always, I look forward to your input. So now, we'll get on with the show. Well, hello, and happy hump night from somewhere in Middle America. Hope you guys are all having a good week. We're coming on to a long weekend. Looking forward to that. Mostly looking forward to it stopping raining. We're having a pretty bad thunderstorm right now, so hopefully you won't hear that, but you might hear my wind chimes. Ironically, I do my show on my quote-unquote sun porch, but tonight, not so much. It's the storm porch. So in any case, want to thank you all for being here. For those of you who are new around here, Recovery Now is a gathering place for anyone seeking recovery from the challenges of life on life's terms. Guests share their experience, strength, and hope. We discuss useful tools that have helped us lighten the load of our journey through recovery. More will be revealed. This is a we recovery program because it is in the we that we find the new me. We focus on the four A's of recovery: awareness, acceptance, action, and adaptation. This is a place for survivors striving to become thrivers, and for that, it takes a good bit of warrior. Again, I'm your host, Kim Justice. For more on me, you can check out my website, inaflash.org. And there may be another reason that you would want to check that out. We've got a really packed show tonight. And first of all, we're going to have on Rico Petrini, who is an all-conference linebacker and team MVP at Oregon State. He was on my show March 23rd during Brain Injury Awareness Month in the second hour. So if you want to know more particulars about Rico, you can either go to inaflash.org to where my shows are listed, or you can look through a whole lot more shows by going to braininjuryradio.com in the on-demand section and just find the March 23rd show of Recovery Now. And there's a slider when you push the link, a timer, so you don't have to listen to the first hour if you don't want to. Pull it to the second hour and you can hear more on Rico's story. But he's going to co-host with me tonight, and then Ken Bartolo is going to join us in a little while, who's a two-sport college athlete, both football and lacrosse, just over a year with the Buffalo Bills on and off practice squad professionally, as well as 3 years of professional lacrosse with Rochester Grey Wolves. After 24 concussions, he went from an active motivational speaker to quite a few less engagements. Symptoms started presenting themselves 13 years ago. His diagnosis went from post-concussion syndrome to CTE within a year. Towards the end, we're also going to be discussing Justin Bannon, NFL player for 9 years with multiple teams. He was confirmed to have suffered brain injury from multiple hits and begun a rapid decline culminating in an act of violence in a delusional state. He received 16 years for the incident, was not allowed to present brain injury-related information or suspected CTE, nor have any experts speak to behavior associated with his injury. He has a brain shunt currently in a Colorado prison awaiting appeal or compassionate care release as his health is rapidly declining without medical care. So tonight, that's a lot of ground to cover. I was going to say, and it all starts with a concussion. A sport and a concussion was going to be the title tonight. But one of the things that's really bothered me over the years, particularly when I've had on athletes who have played football, and knowing the money and many different conspiracies that the NFL has been involved in, it makes me angry because, as many of you know, I've had on a lot of NFL players, a lot of football players. And one of the things that I'll never forget, years ago, right after concussion came out, Chris Nowinski was on my show, and I said, after we talked about, and that is also an interview that's in my On Demand, after we talked about CTE and donating brains and everything we talked about, I said, if you had it to do over, would you do it again? And he said, yes. And I couldn't believe it after what we had just talked about for a couple hours. So the first thing I said was, would you do it over again if you knew that you were not insured? And he said, well, no. No, of course not. And I said, well, you might be surprised to learn that there's only one company willing to insure, the NFL. Now, my background was 25 years as a financial consultant, and I set up a lot of employee benefit packages. And one thing I know is, as predatory as insurance companies can be, that when you've got actuaries from all of the companies saying, this risk is so bad, we can't even come up with an amount of money that would make it worth our risk. And the answer is no. And then you've got one company that will. What's the impetus of that one company that will? Well, they're the gamblers, and they're going to charge as much as they want to charge. They're going to put limits, like from the neck up, on the amount that they'll pay for a claim. All kinds of interesting things can go on, and you're at their mercy. No pun intended. They're the only game in town. The other thing that I've heard out of pretty much all of the athletes when I talk to them about their condition and what happened is the why in the beginning, just curiosity, you know, what drove people to the sport that they were interested in. And I always hear the values that are taught, the values that they learned, you know, how to be a team player, how to win gracefully, lose gracefully, have each other's back, the values. And what I've said to the injured players in the past is, I would wish as a society and as parents that we could teach our kids those values in a way that didn't potentially hurt them or kill them. But the more I thought about it, the more interviews I've had over the years, I've thought, okay, so where do those values go after a player's been hurt? Where is the we then? Where is the NFL? Where is the league then? The ones who have your back, the ones that talk team, the one that say we're all a family? Where are they when you're the player who's now alone with the brain injury, scared, game-changing event, and the we happens to be family, if they're still left, who are impacted all? The league's not there. The team's not there. And again, me not being an athlete, this is just my opinion and how I looked at it. The NFL reminds me of ancient Roman history I took back in college, where the privileged watched the gladiators, their enjoyment, their pleasure, and when a player got injured, they threw him to the lions and tapped someone else to come up and play. There wasn't care or concern, and there wasn't any pretense back in ancient Roman history. The problem now is that on the surface, it looks like they care. But the more players I've spoken to and about these lawsuits that happened, they feigned regret, sorrow, whatever you want to call it, even though they knew and they hid the evidence for decades from their family of players and allowed this to happen. But they still didn't come clean when they got caught. They're dragging out the lawsuits until some players have died, given up, or any obstacle they could put in the way. And that's kicking somebody when they're down. That's no mercy. So I got no respect for a league or an employer that would do that to players, employees who have given their lives, their time, their health, their family, to be part of that team, and now they're on their own. So the name of tonight's show is Do No Harm, not the league motto with CTE for the NFL. And in fact, it does all start with a concussion. So I'm going to bring on Rico now, and we're going to talk. He's going to give you a little bit of background. We're going to talk about, see, March, April, May, been a couple months since he's been on, see what, I know he's been doing some further testing. One thing I really admire about Rico is that he is working hard, studying hard to learn everything he can from the time he got a diagnosis, and he knows a lot. And I know that most of us, when we first get a diagnosis or have a severe brain injury and come out of the ethers, are frozen like a deer in the headlights, and maybe he was too when he got it. But then the level of our quality of life is going to have a lot to do with the positive action we're willing to take, the knowledge we're able to acquire, and the ability to pass that on and know that we're helping others or giving them, again, no pun intended, a heads up on making an informed choice. I don't know that football is going to go away anytime soon, but the lawsuits will, because now it's out there. It's out there what repeated concussions can potentially do to you. So there will be no basis for a lawsuit. So it's more important than ever that people not come out with a it'll never happen to me attitude, number one, because all of us have said that. And it'll never happen to me? Why not? It happened to the other guy. It can certainly happen to me. And I'm sitting here today in my own case saying, I didn't get the chance to say it'll never happen to me. It just happened. And then it was me for a long time. So with that, I'm going to bring on Rico Petrini.
Hey.
Welcome
evening,
back,
Sam. How
Rico.
Are you?
I'm
Thank you.
Good.
Thanks for having me back. I really appreciate it.
It's good. Great
that was a,
to have
powerful...
you back.
Thank you. That was a powerful opening. Your family analogy is struck home with me. I had never had it turned that way. You know, family to players is very strong, and there's a bond with all of us. But for you to actually, flip that and have it that the league, you know, and how they treated us as family, you know, that's a very poignant perspective of, how, you know, it's not reciprocal with the treatment, both at college and the NFL level. But, you know, there is hope that there are things that can happen through awareness and through some changes that are pretty simple to make. So hopefully we can cover some of those tonight and share with your audience some of the background and where we were and, you know, where we could be in the future with the game and with CTE overall. So I wanted to start out first by talking a little bit about the NFL and the NCAA history. Both of them have a common tie with how concussions were treated. You know, back in approximately 1932, one of the first, cases or diagnosis of a concussion-type incident was listed as pugilista dementia, which is, you know, punch drunk from boxers. However,
right.
that carried over as well to the NCAA handbook, which at or near that time, they actually had a very detailed protocol for how to treat concussions with players. The observation period, the minimum time they needed to stay out, the fitness test to check their lung capacity and balance before returning to play. Now, what's incredible about that is we're talking, you know, roughly 90 years ago, we had kind of our first touches with the fact that, you know, concussions can do some significant damage. And the NCAA probably wrote its best documentation about how to treat it then. And since
yeah.
then, you know, it has kind of progressed to a point or regressed, I should say, to a point where it's more about who has liability for what and kind of how can we shake that from ourselves and reduce our exposure versus, you know, from a player perspective, making sure that we're protected and cared for and have a feeling that we can go out on the field and, you know, if we do have an injury, that it'll be properly looked after. So, you know,
right.
that kind of takes us, yeah. So it takes us to the period, where I'm sorry, go ahead.
No, I'm sorry. I was just going to say one of the things, you know, one of the laws with all good intent that, and it rings back, harkens back to what you just talked about, you know, have been legislation that, you know, instead of just giving somebody smelling salts, patting them on the rump and sending them back out after getting hit, even if they were blacked out for a moment, but even if they weren't, you know, because we did go back to that, I've seen it, you know, so somewhere they lost that 1930s protocol, but now they have some laws that have been put into place in various states about an amount of time that someone should stay out. I hear them talk about it passing the television before I change the channel.
Yeah.
You know, that the person is out of the next game and will be back the following week. Well, you know, again, from being here every week and talking to people with brain injuries, a lot of those go on to suffer a concussion. They're so common, you know, that you don't have to be on the football field to get one. But, you know, there's a lot of people who don't present with symptoms until later. And it's all self-policing. You know, you've got a doctor who often works for the team. You've got a coach who gets paid, you know, by the league and to win and all of that. You got the player who wants to play, doesn't want to let the teammates down, maybe isn't functioning after he's, quote-unquote, had his bell rung, with clarity of thought. And so it kind of reminds me of the ADA, the Americans with Disability Act. It was phenomenal when they wrote that piece of legislation, but too often there's no teeth in it. A law
right.
is only as good as the ability to enforce it. And the problem I see, people with good hearts taking positive action like I talk about by going out and getting some of this legislation passed, the only flaw I see in it is that the illness, the incident isn't that predictable. Sometimes, you know, when they say he'll be out for a week, he'll be out for 2 weeks, he might not even be going to exhibit the worst of the problems from that hit until 6 months down the road, maybe a year or two or 10 down the road. So to take
right.
them out of one or two games, the answer. And so anyway, I won't interrupt further. Go on. It was just interesting when you were talking protocols like that, players would almost be better playing without a helmet. You know, I'm from Husker land here, and I'm trying to think that we were called the Bug Eaters back then, and there's an old photo famous in Nebraska because there ain't a lot going on in Nebraska, so the Huskers are a big deal. And there's a photo all over the place of the team back when they wore leather helmets back in the day.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And they'd almost be better off going back to that. At least you'd know to be careful. Some of the helmet makers, I won't let come and be guests on the show, are talking about, you know, building the better mousetrap, building the safer helmet. That does not stop what's going on in the brain. No matter how much padding you put around your head, it isn't going to stop the jelly-like brain from slamming into the knotty bar-like skull. And so the damage is still going to be done. And to declare that someone has a concussion after the fact, they're probably not going to quit because of that. But the repeated concussions just aren't good news, as you know. So now I'll shut up and let you go on.
Yeah, no, that's spot on. I mean, that, you know, I myself, I had 25 plus concussions. And you know, you at the time, you know, I played in the early 90s, and the concussion protocol then, which covers a pretty good span of this timeline that we're dealing with now with CTE, as you know, because a lot of the cases present in between your late 40s to early 50s. So those are my peers. You know, I've lost a few friends from this, and, you know many others who have as well, because we were at that, unfortunately, that time frame where there wasn't a good concussion protocol in place. You know, the concussion protocol was, you know, run the flashlight across their eyes, check their pupils, and then, you know, have somebody stay with you overnight and make sure you got woken up every couple hours, which we now know is the wrong thing to do. You definitely should not be waking somebody up every couple hours after a concussion. And you know, we know that the rest period should be 3 days, 72 hours, and then you proceed into doing some moderate workouts, but definitely not contact. And as you, to your point, Kim, we now know as well that, you know, post-concussion symptoms can last, you know, 6 months, and now we're even getting cases where it's up to a year or a year plus. So, as you said, you know, taking somebody out for one game is often only setting them up to have second impact syndrome, where they actually get a concussion
yeah.
on the concussion and can risk mm-hmm. very well risk death. Now, the interesting thing with college level, which is, you know, what I can speak to, because Ironically, I was not medically cleared to play professional ball because of my concussions, which, you know, I'm thankful now that they did me that favor because I may not be here. But at the NCAA level, they changed their bylaws during this timeline and took the medical responsibility away from the NCAA and placed it onto the schools directly. Now, you mentioned that there is a concussion protocol, and you will see that on the NCAA site, you know, that they have a concussion protocol in place, and they kind of have this, you know, detailed flow chart of what is to happen. But if you really read between the lines, the ultimate onus on the concussion program is with the school itself. They are not obligated to comply with the concussion guidelines, as they call them. So that kind of creates a quandary, as you said, that in different situations, you know, the school may not be, or, you know, the situation with coaching staff or whatever, it may not best suited for the player's health, you know, that it's organized that way, because one school may have a totally different or more lax policy than another school, let's say. And that's really not something that you ask on your recruiting trip. You know, that's the last thing you think of. Now, another interesting thing that most people don't realize is that the players' families are obligated to pay their medical insurance. So, you know, when I go into, and I was part of college football, the insurance was covered by my parents. So, you know, that's not the school's responsibility per se either. So these injuries ultimately can stack up against parents and or family. And, you know, you've got these surgeries or things that may occur that could be quite costly. Now, the schools can pick up the costs, and they can cover your surgeries or what have you, but they're not obligated to do so. Your primary is listed as your family's medical insurance. And then the last piece to the puzzle is, you know, your scholarships. You know, everybody talks about, I got a full-ride scholarship. The scholarships are one-year renewals. So when you sign, you know, each year you then re-sign on your commitment. And, you know, if you get hurt, it is not uncommon for some programs to cut guys loose, you know, to save money on the scholarship or what have you, or to have spots open for additional players. So, you know, the myth that, you know, oh, if I get hurt, I'm going to be here 5 years, that's not necessarily the case. And so you find players that have these catastrophic accidents, they get hit with all the medical bills, and then on top of it, they can't finish their education. And as you know, anything with brain-related injury, I mean, the scans and the follow-up and the therapy and the various specialists, you could see 10, 12 specialists. You could be talking, you know, starters at, you know, $100,000 to $200,000 of medical costs, you know, right out the gate. So it's as you talked about from your insurance background, it's something we don't think about until it actually happens. And it's quite scary when you put it in that perspective that, you know, there is that potential exposure for people that are playing. Now, the NCAA for college did just have a settlement. They started their own studies on concussions back in around 1996, and they had a suit filed by several football players relating to their injuries, and it went on for a few years in, you know, the mid-2000s. And then finally settled out and was effective February 18th, 2020. This settlement, the good news for it is any player at the collegiate level from prior to July 15th of 2016 when the suit was filed can have medical monitoring for a span of 50 years. So all of your scans and x-rays related to concussion or brain injury are covered as part of the suit. What is not covered is any of your other medical costs or any damages or your inability to work or anything like that. So it's a very narrow settlement. And so it is one, though, that they wave the flag and say, you know, we're taking care of players, we're doing these things. But the secondary part of this, to your point, is you made earlier about the team doctors. This screening can only be done through designated facilities that the NCAA has set up in the various regions. So in most cases, you have to travel to the quote third party and have your scans or reviews done by someone that they actually selected, not that you selected. So, when you start thinking about this, it's far more complicated than what many of us had to do on the field, this life after, especially with a brain injury. Now, on the NFL side, the first CTE was discovered by Dr. Amalu, who was one of your guests in the past, in 2002. The NFL tried to discredit him initially, and his work, but it was later verified by others, including Boston University, that the premise was in fact correct, and what he was saying about the subconcussive hits are just as dangerous as the concussions themselves. So in 2009, the NFL actually did their own study and then quickly retracted it because it said that players were 19 times more likely to have neuro disease than the regular public. So that severity and difference between, the public and the players clearly showed that there's something going on with all of these hits. However, that, like I said, that study was quickly retracted and the NFL didn't pursue any further studies like that. Moving forward, if you want to learn more about the NFL and how they handle things, a great documentary was done by Michael Kirk in 2013 with PBS's Frontline called League of Denial. And I know you mentioned concussion, which is Dr. Amalu's story, but League of Denial is probably every player's story. It is probably the most accurate portrayal that could be done of what truly was going on at the time. So if people get a chance, that's on YouTube right now. You can find it pretty easily. It's free, and it's a great watch. I think it's about an hour and 50 minutes, but it kind of goes over the history that, I'm briefly trying to gloss over here. So
no, it is a really good one. In fact, he was a guest too, and there's another documentary similar, and I'll try to think of it while we're talking tonight, but I do highly recommend as well checking out League of Denial, and I saw it on PBS, so I didn't know it was on YouTube now. That's really great information. And also, just backing up for a second, and then I'll have you go on, is the incidental costs, just not incidental, but wanting to go over that again, that the injury fell under the parent's insurance. But, there is a limit on most health insurances. Some of them are going to unlimited now, but they used to be $2 or $3 million. And you're right, at the cost of these scans and the follow-up, you could burn through the family's health insurance in not much time at all. But the other thing going on then a little bit later, when I was dealing with individuals and they wanted to buy individual disability income insurance or income loss insurance, loss of income insurance, or life insurance, one of the questions is always, do you participate in any hazardous sports such as motor-powered racing, Skinner scuba diving? Amazing, I can't remember what I had for lunch, but I can remember applications from 20 years ago. Skydiving, private piloting, or hazardous sports? And if the answer was yes to that question, and you were clean otherwise, healthy, if you had other things going along with it, you were a flat-out denial and just couldn't get the insurance at any price. If you were otherwise healthy, they would cover you but put an exclusion rider on any damage that was done to you in the process of doing one of those hazardous sports or avocations. So you literally did not have any insurance when you did those things. And when you talk about loss of income and the age that these people are, you know, that are high school even, you know, and Pop mm-hmm. Warner to high school to college, you know, their insurability can be gone, you know, at a very early age, and that is huge if they're not able to work. That makes really the, you know, generous of them to be willing to do the scans, but that, you know, can pretty well put you at poverty level. All of those other costs that you brought up that I'm sure a lot of people don't think of, you know, when they sign off on the release for their kid or earlier on, or then, you know, later in college sign the releases, they're thinking, well, great, my injury will be covered, and not thinking of the lifetime of expenses of not being able to work and all of the things that come with, you know, a lot of us develop chronic pain issues, depression or anxiety issues, behavioral issues, sleep disorders, so many other things come out of these brain injuries, and they would be in the not covered section, I'm sure, of the NCAA plan. So that was very helpful for you to bring that up, because I don't think people think of that. You know, when you want to do, also from being a salesperson, I guess, when you want to do what you want to do, you're going to hear what you want to hear, you know, and they're counting on that, you know, the leagues are counting on that you're going to hear what you want to hear, and you're not going to catch that between the lines you were talking about. So thank you for shedding some light on that.
Well, and to your point, with both post-concussion syndrome and, you know, serious, you know, TBIs, and even, you know, with further down the road suspected CTE, generally one of the first things that manifests is a behavioral trait difference. So, you know, whether it's anxiety or severe depression. And so what do you think happens? Instead of understanding what the underlying condition is, they treat that symptom. And, you know, again, it's a better situation for them to get people back on the field than to find out something that may hold somebody off for a year, you know. And so most often it's treated that you've got anxiety, here's a prescription for that, or you've got depression and here's a prescription for that. And in reality, these people are still exhibiting post-concussion syndromes that then get compounded further from additional, you know, subconcussive hits while they're playing. So it's a really precarious position, and I think it really stresses the need to make sure that, you know, entities that like the NCAA that are there and are this, you know, supposed to be this unified beacon, you know, where they still control steroid testing, they still control the drug testing and the randomization of that, they still control eligibility based on your grades. You know, it just seems very odd that they don't have the kind of control that they have in these other areas to make sure that brain injuries and brain health is treated consistently across the board. And that's where, you know, I kind of am at a loss with this personally, that it isn't a required protocol rather than a suggested guideline, you know, and maybe that's something that will develop down the road. But it seems to me more of a liability exclusion than it is a health benefit to the players.
Well, it's greed to the entities involved. You know, it comes down to what so many things do, unfortunately, and that's greed. They're not looking out for the health of the players. They're looking to, you know, I don't know. Again, I don't want to slam my own state. It's no different than any other state. But do you know how much money is made in Husker Nation? ain't nobody in a hurry to be making any big changes.
Football is the cash crop for most schools. And so that's why there's, why things are set up in some ways the way that they are, unfortunately. But, you know, moving forward again with the NFL side of it, that Frontline documentary, what was interesting about it is, you know, Michael Kirk was supposed to produce that with ESPN. And right before it went into production, ESPN pulled out for fears and some of the kind of covert threats that were being made by the NFL in terms of their access to coverage and so forth on future games. So they backed out completely and left Michael Kirk kind of holding the bag. And yet, you know, he still pulled this off and, you know, was awarded an Emmy for it. So, you know, that kind of strengthens that really it was not bought. There's nobody on here. You know, this is out of pocket, direct, no sponsors, no, you know, no CBS, ESPN. This was, you know, public funding, public broadcast by, production that was out of pocket for the most part. So, again, a really great documentary that I think shows a lot for your listeners when they get a chance to see that, or if they haven't already. But, you know, back to the settlement, you know, that did make a lot of waves, and it caused another round of settlements, lawsuits towards the NFL instead of the NCAA this time. And those kind of carried on for a couple years, and then in 2017, the settlement finally moved forward. And later in that year, Boston University Brain Bank study came out, and it's, you know, from its study of the first 111 NFL player brains that they were donated, 110 of them had CTE. And then for college, the first 53, 48 of them had CTE. So, you know, this definitely, you know, now you've got another situation where, it's definitely showing that there's something very serious going on here. So moving forward with that, you know, the NFL did push with the settlement. The settlement was initially, I think, around $500 million. What was not known at the time was the details of the settlement. And the details of the settlement was that the NFL didn't have to provide any internal documents or records, you know, as to some of the accusations that were made by Frontline and by others about just what was happening behind the scenes and who knew what. So that information was not required to be released. In addition, players had to resubmit their claims to be heard. And so the awards were supposed to be based from $50,000 to $2 million. And the factors on that were basically your years of play, the extent of your injuries, and, you know, your cognitive defects that they could actually document. And so, you know, that included there was actually a death payment because some of the plaintiffs had actually died during the process of actually having this be heard. One of the unfortunate things that came out of it is that the NFL also used race-based scoring to try to make a claim, you know, to try to actually make it more difficult for African-American athletes to be able to actually get their settlement. They had changed the criteria and scoring weight and weighted the scoring differently in an attempt to actually keep, you know, those players from being able to receive their benefits as well. So, you know, it's, you know, this is all facts. This is all well documented. They just expanded. The judge actually expanded the claim now on the settlement to, I believe it's an unlimited open claim. So now it's just you come in, you file your claims against it, and the NFL has to set aside and pay towards those. Now, the big problem is that let's say you do win and you do get your claim heard, which is, you know, an exhausting process. And they have their own doctors, independent doctors that evaluate it. You have to provide all your records. The teams themselves didn't provide very good records. Most of the players at the time didn't want the records because they were afraid they would be replaced if they had anything on record. But if you did go through that whole process and get an award, there was a holdback of costs against potential debtors. So if you fail to pay a hospital bill in the future, you know, they estimated X amount of dollars per year would be used for medical care, they would hold that back in anticipation just in case that you didn't pay your medical bills. And so some of these families actually ended up with, you know, going from the $50,000 minimum or $2 million max, you know, down to a couple thousand dollars. And embarrassingly, in a couple cases, because of the way it was weighted, a couple ended up in negative ratios where they actually looked like they owed the league money. So it just really was not a well-conceived settlement. And again, it allowed the secrets to be buried because none of the information that was known has ever had to be publicly divulged. And the players themselves at this point are, you know, in this cycle where it's a waiting game. And unfortunately, many of them are passing away or their families do give up, as you said, before they actually get their payments. So that's really kind of the history of things to where we are now. One of the things that's been interesting is, you know, the NFL does like to do campaigns for everything. We have the pink ribbons for breast cancer. We have, the military service days and some of the other recognition days that they do. But they haven't actually done anything for CTE awareness. And that was or Brain Injury Awareness Month. They didn't actually do anything at all during that whole time frame. So, yeah, it's kind of interesting that they, with everything that has happened and everything that they know now, you would expect maybe something would come out of that if, you know, they were genuinely looking to kind of help that community. So just one of those other between the lines things that you look at and you go, what are we really, what really drives things?
Well, they've been found out, but my estimation is they only do what they have to, because I expected some of those other things too, but you're really admitting to the world and all of the players what you have to look forward to, and I'm sure they want to play that down. You know, they're going to address what goes public. I mean, I've seen how some were treated, even by other players. You look at, like, when you were talking about one of the first things that exhibits is behavior problems. You know, I was thinking of Hernandez. There's a few, heaven forbid, you know, Ray Cagliani, who was on, the former boxer, when he was on, you know, he was a scrapper. Right. When he was a kid, he got in a lot of fights, and it wasn't, he was always like protecting the kids that were getting bullied. But the point is, you know, he was a scrapper. He got in trouble a few times as a kid. So it made it easy later for a faction of the population to say, well, that kid's always been a bad seed anyway, nothing new in this behavior. And I've seen him use that strategy before. Now, if you were a kid who is completely different and somebody could point out, I mean, a shift that was night and day, a shift, it might be a little easier. But if you were always someone who had some fight in you, some aggression in you, then I've seen a lot of people try to write off, even professionals and leagues try to write off some of these injuries as just that part of it when it exhibits, is letting things go further down the road and more damage because they don't attribute it to the injury. They attribute it to the person always having been that way. You know, and just one more thing I wanted to mention, and then we'll bring Ken on here pretty quick here, but is just while we're talking about this, I do want to bring up again one more time that, you know, when you talked about the old way of treating concussion, like when I was a kid, the flashlight and the waking a person up. I want to reiterate that a concussion doesn't take a actual physical blow to the head. You don't have to be knocked out. You can have such a thing as I had from a fall, but players get it all the time from getting jerseys jerked and all kinds of different ways. I've seen it happen on the field, but a whiplash concussion. And so you right. haven't clanged heads at all. You know, you haven't taken a direct hit to the head at all that anyone can see. You haven't been knocked out, but they're just as damaging. I got post-concussion syndrome from a fall, having a whiplash concussion in back of the damage that I had from having had my stroke, my aneurysm. And so I think that's important, because a lot of people, each time we have a show like this, I want to clarify all of these details that people aren't hearing, because in the media, like with everything else, you're only hearing what they want you to hear. So you're hearing things that are inescapable, that the NFL or any league can't get out of making a comment on. And then the things you don't see, you know, the people who are still big fans and also aren't concerned with the health of the player, are concerned with their entertainment, you know, and going to keep watching and don't want to turn their back on the sport. There's things that they just don't want to believe. So when things don't come up, they don't think of it unless it's pointed out. And so, you know, again, bringing up what constitutes a concussion, I think, is important, because a lot of people still think that somebody needs to be clocked and knocked out and carried off the field for it to count. And that is not at all the fact.
No, that's a great point, Kim, because 80% of what they ironically call MTBIs, mild traumatic brain injuries, you know, but I mean, they're called that. The definition of a mild traumatic brain injury is that you don't lose consciousness. And 80% of brain injuries being concussions, people don't lose consciousness. So it's actually the majority of the cases that an individual won't lose consciousness. And so that's kind of one of those old, you know, wives' tales too, that, you know, you think that the person has to be out with the smelling salts to truly have had a concussion. I was just up at my old college and met with a couple of the players and their wives that I had played with. We were kind of sitting around watching a spring game. And one of the wives proceeded to tell me about the very first game I had as a freshman, and how on one of the first plays of the game I had a pretty massive hit. And she said, I said, I don't really remember that. She goes, yeah, you, after that game, you were locked in our bathroom crying for the whole night. And that was the first time I had ever heard of that. I mean, I didn't even know I had a concussion in that game. I played the whole game. And, you know, from the film and anything else, you would never know that I had a concussion. But obviously I exhibited concussion symptoms after that, where I was completely out of it, and, you know, crying and all the other things that kind of go with, you know, a pretty serious brain injury. So, you know, that's the kind of stuff, you know, now I look at it and, you know, I've got, you know, I'm 50 years old now versus the 17-year-old indestructible. And like you said, you know, chronic pain,
right.
You know, over 50 symptoms, you know, double vision, vertigo, tinnitus, pressure in the head, you know, issues with, you know, my heart rate, you know, you name it, you know, compressed discs in my neck. And you just look at all that and you go, this stuff will catch up to you, you know, in time. You know, give it that time, it does come. And, you know, the CTE symptoms, when they come, it comes with a flurry. And it catches a lot of people off guard. And unfortunately, you know, the way it's been handled is that it's mental illness in many cases, because the behavioral things come up first. And I would just really encourage people to look deeper than that, especially if they have a history of, you know, contact sports or head injuries, and the behavior is not typical of what that person had behaved like throughout most of their life, you know, which was the case with me. The things that were being exhibited, I had never been that way at any other point in my life. And it just, out of the blue, you have these behaviors that just don't match up with the person.
Right. Right. Yeah. Well, should we bring on Ken?
Yeah, Ken, it'd be great to talk about his career with the NFL and his own shares about his experience with, you know, what was, you know, told to him and what was known and what was not known. And, you know, I think he can really share a lot of his experience, plus some of the people that he knows from playing in the league and what they've shared with him as well. So.
Okay, great. Well, again, Ken Bartolo was both a football and a lacrosse player, 5 years of college football. Well, I'll let him tell you, a year and 8 weeks with the Buffalo Bills on and off the practice squad professionally, as well as 3 years of professional lacrosse with Rochester Gray Wolves. I'm going to let him tell you the rest and bring Ken Bartolo on with us. Ken, welcome to the show. Yeah. Thanks so much for being here tonight.
Yes, thank you for having me. That was amazing. I was to you guys. And it was almost like you were telling my story. Obviously, I mean, I was an elite athlete at a very young age, and it was obvious. And I got my first concussion, I think, when I was 12, and I was knocked out. And I didn't find out for probably until about 30 years later that had damaged my brain, that had damaged my myelin sheath. I don't know if that's exactly how you pronounce it, but that I had already had damage and that I was already prone to getting more concussions. At that age, I was knocked out and taken to the hospital in an ambulance. That's why I'm strong advocate. Yeah, I'm a very strong advocate for no tackle football until you get to high school. Very strong advocate for that. Only flag until you get to high school. But then, you know, when I got to high school, very heavily recruited all over the country. Ended up playing in college. Probably in high school, I would say I had 5 or 6 concussions. But played on an outstanding high school football team. You know, we won the state championship. I mean, everything you could imagine. Actually, me and my best friend ended up playing in college, both playing professionally. And he, as well as I, have suspected CTE. When I got to college, I redshirted, played 5 years. Redshirted and played 4 years. Over the course of those 4 years, made all East Coast 3 of 4 years. And I think I got 12 concussions, but in my senior year, I got 6 in that one season. And, I mean, I was doing insane things. After the third one, they pulled me out for a week. And I would go out to practice in my civilian clothes. And I'd get in the huddle. You know what I mean? Like, I thought I had my pad.
Oh, I gotcha.
And they'd be like, you're not playing this week. And then I think 2 weeks later, we were playing in a game. I was actually going in for a touchdown, and the other team's middle linebacker was an All-American, and he just knocked me out. And when I got up to their sideline, you know what I mean? Went to their side. I'm talking to the coach. I'm like, what's the play? What's the play? And he was like, I remember what he said to me. He said, son, you're in red today, weren't green. I had no idea what he was talking about. And they called the ambulance. I was in the hospital, and it was interesting what Rico said, because I remember I went to the hospital, and they wouldn't let me lay down for about, it was at least 20 hours. I don't know why, but they wouldn't let me lay down. And then, like Rico said, they made my girlfriend wake me up every 45 minutes.
God.
I guess it was they thought I was going to a coma or whatever. But I remember that. She had to wake me up every 45 minutes. And about 7 games into that season, they were just like, that's it. You're done. Because I had gone to the hospital probably 3 or 4 times, and I had at least 6 concussions. And these are concussions like you guys were talking about. You know, the guy's out. And knowing what I know now about concussions, I have no idea how many I'd had. You know, I didn't know that when you see stars, that's a concussion. You know what I mean? I just thought that was a thing.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? I didn't know that when, you know, your head jerked really hard to one side, that was a concussion. You know what I mean? Because your head basically sits like an your brain sits like an egg in your head. You know what I mean? Like you guys were talking about, no helmet in the world is going to stop the movement in there, inside your head.
Right.
I don't like telling the guys that make helmets either. You know what I mean? That
yes.
There's no helmet that's going to make them stop that movement inside the head. And then, like you guys were talking about, CTE is not caused by concussions. It's caused by those tens of thousands of blows that you get over a 20-year career. You know, I played football from when I was 8 until I was 28. You know, I can't count how many times I was, you know, I got a mild hit to my head. You know, there's no number for it. And then you combine 20 to 25 years of lacrosse with that, and I think what they did was take the number of years and then divided it from football by a third. You know what I mean? Because you don't get hit every play in lacrosse. But, I mean, I got knocked on my butt for 28 years. You know what I mean? In lacrosse, if you're one of the guys that goes to goal, you're going to get decked.
Yeah.
So both of them contributed to the CTE, but obviously more in football. I think out of my concussions, 20 of them were from football, and then maybe 4 from lacrosse. And every level, you know, you go from high school to college, Rico knows this, the game gets twice as fast. The athletes are twice as strong. So you have to adapt to that. And
right.
You know, your freshman year, you're trying to get bigger, stronger, faster. Your sophomore year, you're a little bigger, stronger, faster. Your junior, senior year. But so was everybody else. And by the time I got to the Bills, they were just so strong, so fast. I mean, when they blew the whistle, the only way I can describe it, because I play wide receiver, when they blew that whistle and then the linemen hit each other, it sounded like a train wreck. That's how loud it was. Just because the guys are so big, so strong, you know, and then they're going full bore. The only way I can describe it is every play is a train wreck. You know, I wouldn't imagine being an offensive lineman or a defensive lineman or a linebacker. And of course, Rico knows what I'm talking about with that. You know, he plays very high-level college football, and if it weren't for concussions, I'm sure he would have played for the 49ers. As a receiver, you know, you don't get hit every play, but you do get those severe hits. You know, if I'm going across the middle, I got a guy 6'2", 240 that runs a 4.5 coming at me full speed. If I catch the ball or not, you know what I mean? He's going to hit me full ball.
Yeah.
You know, that pretty much the equivalent of getting hit by a car at 30 miles an hour. You know, and I did that for 20 years, you know, and it, like I said, every level I went up, bigger, stronger, faster, more impact. And to be honest with you, when I got let go by the Bills, I was relieved. I was relieved. You know, I was a fringe guy, practice player. You know, I wasn't one of those superstars that everyone wanted their autograph. I just remember every part of my body had a bruise on it. Everything, my arm, my legs, my chest. There was a bruise everywhere. And after that senior year in college, I knew something was wrong with my brain. It probably took, I want to say, 6 to 8 months just so I could think straight. I felt like I was in a fog. A lot of times it felt like I was drunk. It ended up that I have one eye that's higher than the other one. I have permanent tinnitus, nerve damage in both ears. I remember those 8 months, I knew that something was wrong with my brain, and I just couldn't think, like, get words backwards, you know what I mean? Like, I was L-C-A-E-T. But no one knew what CTE was back there, like that, you know what I mean? I was just like, I got like concussions. But I was fortunate enough to sign with the Bills, and you know, I came from a smaller school, so I was fortunate to even make the practice team. And I just remember how big and, like I said, every level you go up, how much bigger, stronger, and faster they were. And when I got a couple of concussions up there, I was out. I would wake up in the hospital.
One thing I'd like to say about you, okay, Rico, I'm going to ask him something, and then you can ask him something. You know, sure. One thing that breaks my heart hearing your story, Ken, is one of the first things you said about not having contact sports until at least college is, you know, the brain doesn't fully develop until you're in your mid-20s. And so it's unfortunate that the very first hit you got as a kid that knocked you out probably did substantial enough damage that as you were going, getting bigger and stronger at every level, you were already doing it with a handicap you didn't know you had.
Oh, absolutely. I remember the doctor at Mount Sinai. The first question he asked me was about that first concussion. And he said, you've had brain damage since that moment. And they have a CTE clinic down there. And he ran it. And I'll never forget that moment because while he was telling me that, and then I probably had CTE, the PA or whatever was telling my wife, this is going to be harder on you than it's going to be on him. And I overheard her say that to my wife. I'll never forget that moment. And I mean, I was a big kid, you know, at 12, I was a big, strong kid. And it wasn't uncommon as a running back to carry the ball 35, 40 times a game. That's a lot of head-to-head contact. That's why, you know, I am a stern believer, no contact at all until you're in high school.
Well, you know, again, just going back to my point, and then Rico, you can make your comment or ask your question is, you asked me about the different players and doctors, professionals that I've had on the show, but I've also had on, there's a moms group out there, and I've had on 3 or 4 different moms whose kids played from Pop Warner on up, and their sons died in high school, they had they donated their brains, and one young man was a senior, and he had just gone to go to college, but he actually never came out of his room and showed up to his first class. He wound up passing away, and he was already from high school in stage 3 out of 4 of CTE, and the other two young men in high school were in stages 2 out of 4 of CTE.
Yep.
So already in high school, they were at that level of CTE, but of course then they didn't have a suspected CTE. These young men actually had the autopsy and actually were confirmed to have been at those stages of CTE. So, Rico, what was your comment?
Oh, I was just really curious, Ken, with the NFL side of it. When you were up, you mentioned you'd been knocked out cold a couple times. How was that handled? You know, because there's players at that time that said, you know, kind of the mantra was that steroids were a bigger problem than concussions, and you know, if there is no issue with concussions, they go away within a week, or you know, that kind of thing. What was kind of shared with you by the team doctors?
I make no bones about it. I was on steroids, and everyone was. I mean, that's not really a secret. Was it a bigger issue than concussions to the public? Was looking back now, obviously concussions were a way bigger problem. You know what I mean? Here's why it was a problem. A, players would never report it. You know what I mean? You don't want to report it to your coach. You don't want to miss a game. You don't want to lose your spot. Players are very reluctant to report it unless, you know, coaches see it or you get knocked out or, you get up and you're stumbling around and it's obvious. If I got one where, you know, I just couldn't see very well or I saw stars or, you know, I've gotten concussions and played the whole game and played well, played very well and forgot. And just never told anybody about it. So players are very reluctant to report them. And then when you do report them, I mean, I get injury reports where, you know, I told them my head and my neck are killing me, and they write up a shoulder report. That's commonplace. That's commonplace. They're not going to write up a neck or a head injury. Unless you had to go to the hospital or it's obvious.
Even though that's what you complained about, you didn't complain about a neck or a shoulder injury. You came out and said, my head is killing me.
Yeah.
They wrote it different.
Yeah, I would say 90% of head injury, they would write the report up as something. And you don't know what they're writing in the report. You know what I mean? I didn't even know where I was half the time. So they're going to write the report up however they want. And, you know, you don't get access to it until you're retired. So the first problem is you're not going to report. Second problem is how they're going to write it up. The third problem is the protocol. You know what I mean? They do think you have a concussion, like you guys said. Give them the smelling salts and put them back out there. You know, it's nothing like it is today, where they're going to hold you out for 2 weeks or 3 weeks or 4 weeks. It was, you know, can he stand up? Can he run? You know, follow my finger. If you can do that stuff, you're going back out there.
So the NFL largely didn't validate that you had a brain injury from playing football and try to help you, support you from those injuries?
Well,
they were going off the medical reports you're talking about where they weren't even telling the truth. And one thing I'm wondering just real quick, like if it's any different in football, but legally other people, we are entitled to have a copy of our medical report. The doctors often don't want to give them. They often give you some slack. They often drag it out. They do whatever. But legally, we are all entitled to copies of our medical reports. Unless there's a rule I don't know about in the NFL, then I would really suggest to anybody who's playing ball or in sports that you get and keep copies of your medical records for a couple reasons. First of all, you can help keep the parties honest, but the other is chances are you're going to be seeing a number of different doctors over the course of your life, and they're going to be acting on bad information. And so I would highly recommend hearing what I just heard for other people now to be getting copies of their medical reports, unless there's something in sports that disallows you to do what every other person can do.
Yeah, and then the thing is, and it happened in college too, you know, you're 22, you're 23, you're living the life, you know what I mean? You don't want anything to get in the way of that. You know, I didn't ask questions. And then in college, even when I had the 6 concussions, I still wanted to play. You know, if I could walk and I could see, I wanted to play. You know, when I was playing professionally, I had 2 Porsches. You know what I mean? You just, at that age, you didn't think about it. And once again, no one knew what CTE was in the 1990s. You know what I mean? Everyone just knew what concussions were, and no one thought concussions were a big deal. So when you got a concussion, you're just like, yeah, I got a banger. That was pretty much the extent of it. And, you know, having a headache or puking, that was just part of it. You know, I've had a headache for 30 years.
Hey Ken, when you retired or when you stopped playing, was there ever any kind of exit exam that they do or anything like a final physical just to kind of document your status, or do you just kind of get released and take your clothes and get in your car and leave?
Well, it wasn't that abrupt, but no, they didn't do a physical, nothing like that.
Mm.
No physical exam, nothing.
And after all the problems and complaints, you know, one of the other things you said, and I don't know whether it would be any different, and I don't compare it to that, except I can only make an example based on what I know. But when I fell back on our deck and I got that whiplash concussion, because I had a ruptured brain aneurysm and a craniotomy, as I went flying through the air, all I could think of is, please God, don't let me hit my head. Don't let me hit my head. And when I landed on, you know, one leg was, I'm lucky I didn't break it. One leg was like under my butt, and I rocked back on that and then went forward to my arms, my palms, which were my arms were locked straight in front of me. And so I rocked from, you know, back my butt on my leg to forward onto my palms. And that was where my neck just snapped. At that moment, all I could think of is, thank God I didn't hit my head. And then I sat there for a minute while I was seeing stars, but I did the inventory, nothing bleeding, nothing broke. Whew, got it. And then what wound up happening with me, and I wouldn't have even known it if it wasn't for my mom and my husband, 3 months later, saying something a day apart, I wouldn't have even known. And this shocked the hell out of me because I was older. I had been a host on Brain Injury Radio for a long time. I knew nothing from 95 until 2012 or whenever I came to work here and have been here every week. I actually knew something when this happened to me in 2015, I think it was. And I was getting these blinding headaches and just going to the cabinet and taking 3 Advil and just going about my life. But I was getting these headaches like every other day. What scared the hell out of me, finally, 3 months later, I happened to be, because I didn't always tell everybody when I had a headache, I just went and took the Advil.
Yep.
Well, it came up enough times over that period of time that then my mom and my husband within a couple days both said, boy, you're sure having a lot of headaches. It was then that the light bulb went off for me that I had been exhibiting behavior that getting the blinding headaches, thinking nothing of it, not even realizing when I knew better, and I knew better.
Yeah.
But I didn't even realize how abnormal that was to be having these, you know, all of a sudden out of the blue, these blinding headaches, go take my Advil. Then I would go in and lay quietly in the dark bedroom and do deep breathing exercises to help the Advil work. I had a whole routine down and didn't even think about how abnormal that was. That's how clear my thinking wasn't. And that's kind of what you're describing is, you know, you would go out, you would keep doing it, you would keep doing same behavior, expecting different results, and were completely mindless of what the reality of the abnormality of how you were functioning.
Absolutely, absolutely. I forgot what doctor it was, or if we was, you know, saw it on YouTube, but it was a doctor, and he was explaining to my wife, his reality is totally different than your reality, and that's the truth of someone that's got TE or traumatic brain injury. And for caretakers, that, you know, that's a pretty tough pill to swallow, that, you know, my reality is different than her reality. And we do things that seem normal to us that is totally irrational to someone that doesn't have, you know, a master.
Yeah.
Like this.
Well,
week, just last week, she came home, told, you know, I said, listen, I'm having trouble with my head. And my bill stuff is all over me. Like, you know, I still have my helmet, my jersey's in a case. I threw it all over the house. And I'm sitting outside. I didn't even know I did it. She's like, why'd you throw your bill stuff all over the house? And I'll have these fits of rage, I'll have these fits of anger. I mean, on Christmas Eve, was it? I got really violent. I threw my steps on out of the house. It's the behavioral changes are insane. You guys were talking about the anxiety, the depression, the anxiety attacks. They're almost unbearable. You know, stuff like that, that normal people just, you know, very difficult for them to understand.
So have you been in? Go ahead.
Hey, Ken, did your symptoms like come on like in a big wave at once, or kind of how did you kind of start dialing in, you know, this isn't right. You know, was it behavioral first? Was it some physical things? Was it a combo? Because there seems to be a pattern with CTE, and I'm just curious if you kind of follow that mold of and kind of how it came about with you, and if it was in a short period of time, a lot of stuff, or if it just kind of came over a long period.
It started with whenever it was bright out, I would have to lock myself in a dark room for a couple of days. And I was just like, well, you know, they diagnosed me with post-concussion syndrome. And it wouldn't happen every time it was bright. But some days I'd literally just have to lock myself in a dark room for a couple of days, and I just couldn't handle any light. And then the behavioral changes. Like, I've lost a lot of friends. You know what I mean? I just start fist fights with them. Then the anxiety and the depression comes, you know. And then with younger guys, that's usually where it starts, you know, the violent behavior, the anger, the outburst, anxiety and the depression. I definitely had this stuff with the light sensitivity and something. I knew just something was wrong in my head. The cognitive stuff probably started 5 to 7 years later. You know, like just forgetting where my keys were, getting lost. Sometimes, like, I just go somewhere in the neighborhood and call my wife and be like, I don't know where I am. You know what I mean? Watch a TV show and then, do you want to watch this show? And I just watched it. You know, I'd gone to the movie and then come home and wanted to rent, you know, like you could rent them a month later, and forgot I watched them already. And then I watch them again, and it's like I never saw them.
Yeah.
You know?
You never see a rerun in this world. The brain injury world. You never see a rerun.
It's horrible, though. My wife came home. I was sitting in front of the TV. It wasn't on. It was just a black screen. And she's like, what are you doing? I'm like, watching TV. I said, I'm watching the game. Mm. She was like, the TV's not on. You know?
Mm.
And that's just, you know, that's part of the disease.
Rico, we talked a little before, and it lends itself to the question you just asked. For a lot of people out there, they're kind of getting to know what CTE is, but I thought until I talked to you and Ray last March, that a person had to die and have a special type of brain autopsy to be diagnosed. And then all of a sudden in Brain Injury Awareness Month, I run into a cluster of people with suspected CTE. So when you just asked him the question that you did, just for clarity for the people listening and to understand how CTE has progressed, is it now like there's a list of, like Parkinson's doesn't have a definitive test that tells you have Parkinson's. It's basically a checklist, and if you meet a certain amount on the checklist of things that go with it, you get the diagnosis. Is that kind of how this is working now, that people who are living are able to say that they have been diagnosed with probable CTE?
Yeah, that's actually a great question. And that's something, you know, that has just come of recent with, you had talked about Boston U and Anneke and Cantu and Stern and some of the other great neuro doctors, you know, along with others at other schools, Harvard Med and UCSF and some of the others had come together at a symposium, and what they had done is created the first set of criteria to what they determined to be traumatic encephalopathy syndrome. TES is the easy way to say it. And so TES is what they use for in the living. And what it is, it's a set of criteria that they all agree to as neurologists that give a high probability that if you had followed this path or had participated with these items, that, you know, if you had all these physical conditions or variables included and could flowchart downward on it, that in combination with your scan results and, some clinical things that were observable there, like, additional white matter that's for your age is unusual, or some visible damage or shrinkage in certain areas, that in combination with these criteria that they set up for tests, they could then take the two together and say, you are suspected CTE, you're probable, or you're likely to have CTE. Unfortunately, there still is not test. There is still not a lab result way to definitively state that you have CTE in the living yet. But this is as close as we can come. And for purposes of treatment, disability, care, it really is some pretty good modeling. Now, the only thing I would criticize about the modeling is the largest group of traumatic brain injury survivors is from partner violence or domestic violence. And the criteria that they have are more contact sports related when you go down the flowchart, because that's the group that mm-hmm. they work the most with is combat veterans and sports. And so because of that, you have a large segment that's underrepresented and underserved because they can't meet some of the criteria because they didn't play sports to get their injuries and had unfortunate yep. circumstances they obtained theirs. So that would be my only criticism of it is just that, it is a more of a sports or military-based flow model, but it is something that at least they can say with some strong certainty that you have CTE. And, in fact, it's what they use for clinical trials. So they'll run you through the scale and then use that as a basis whether you meet the qualifications for clinical trials that they're doing now.
Yep.
Great. I'm glad to have you explain that, because not everybody understands how this is unfurled. That, like I said before, and I imagine too, they've had a lot more time now to do the autopsies, so there's certain things they're seeing postmortem that I imagine is one of the reasons they were able to come up with this criteria that you're talking about now, Rico, is they know what they're looking for now. They didn't before. The first we were seeing them was in the first autopsy that Amalu did not all that long ago, but now when they started an active campaign of brain donations to do these autopsies, the commonalities had to start being the criteria. And if you were able to see telltale signs of something like that in a live person's brain scans who did have, as you say, that kind of military or sports background, that would be fair enough, good criteria to be able to give that diagnosis. And you're right, other groups are unrepresented, but that's not uncommon. A lot of things we've come to find out about later started in the military and wound up trickling down. So the more we are talking about it and raising awareness, I think the more other groups are going to be able to come under that umbrella and be recognized for the same reasons.
Yeah, and at PU, where Chris is, they have a PET scan, but you have to be a former NFL player to be part of the research study, and that can actually detect the tau protein, which is what causes the CTE. It's a buildup of the tau protein from the stretching of the nerves. But to get the PET scan, you have to be a former NFL player between 45 and 80. Because they sent me the information on it. I can go get a PET scan and see how much tau protein there is in my brain. Closest they've come to detecting it in some that's alive.
You probably should. I think that when they have enough of one thing I heard about clinical trials, because I have interviewed a few clinical trials, is what they try to do to bring something to market or to accomplish something is to do the path of least resistance. And by using football players, that's the quickest way to get from point A to point B, or military, quickest way to get from point A to point B, because you're going to have the numbers there, you're going to have the number of cases there, and once you can prove it there, it becomes easier to bring other groups under the umbrella. They're just not there yet. It's new that you guys are there, but because of the numbers in those two groups, the military and football players, other contact sports, but football in particular, that's where they're going to find the proof they need the fastest to be able
and
to recognize this across the board.
Unfortunately, like you were saying, I think they're going to play more and more cases. Guys that just college or just played in high school, that number's I can't see any way that number's not going to go up. You know what I mean? It's not just there's got to be. I mean, Rico could have played in the NFL, but Rico, you played what, 4 years post high school?
Yeah, I played. I had a redshirt year like you, so I had five years total.
5 years post high school. That they're going to find a lot more in college and high school athletes as time goes on.
Well, I'm going to assume to get to the NFL that you probably had to have started playing as a kid. I doubt many people just get up at the age you go into the NFL and are a great football player and wind up in the NFL. So I think for most, all those people in the NFL, that the damage came long before that and that will be bore out. And the mothers group, is a huge one making a lot of noise out there, thankfully, at this point, from their sons, much younger than the NFL, passing away and having these really rallying to have the autopsies done. But Ken, I want to thank you for being with us tonight. We've got about 20 minutes left, and Rico was going to talk a little bit about, and I'm interested in hearing about Justin Bannon, because when I talked about controversy earlier and some of the things that when one of these violent acts happens, that there's going to come a point where there is a point already where some will think that somebody is making an excuse, using CTE as a defense when it was something different. And then there'll be some maybe more obvious ones where CTE will be a defense. But Rico, tell us a little bit about what you know. And thank you, Ken. I just want to make sure in the just shy of 20 minutes we have left that we get to hear a little bit about Justin Bannon, because that was quite a shocking case. I remember hearing about it. And I remember also hearing at the time a lot of the comments that went on behind that, because the sympathy was with the person who got shot. And then I heard the rumblings of some not necessarily believing that this was as a result of CTE, but more a result of being able to use it as an excuse. So what do you know about this case?
Yeah, well...
Well, why don't you tell first what happened for those that aren't familiar.
Okay. It's a really interesting situation, and I think it's something that is, as things move forward, you know, there's still some active parts to the case and his appeal and so forth, but I think as things move forward, I think people will truly see the human side of CTE, and as we're learning more about CTE, they will understand, you know, like Ken mentioned, this explosive anger that came out of nowhere that wasn't typical of him and his behavior with his family. And, you know, I have had similar situations, you know, from severe depression, dark thoughts, to, you know, situations of explosive anger where the reaction doesn't match the situation. And, you know, unfortunately, you know, with Justin, you know, he has certainly owned up to what had happened. And the basic overview of what had happened is he was not knowing at the time that he was, you know, in a, you know, it wasn't discussed that he had CTE per se. He was in a situation where he was having severe head pressure, you know, some paranoia, you know, some of the early dementia signs, just really struggling overall, which is pretty typical of many people as their CTE symptoms kind of present. You know, he had fluid on his brain as well that was causing extreme head pressure with him. And so on one morning, he had kind of a delusional situation where he ended up going to a building that he owned and went into the inside of the building and just he actually owned it, so he didn't break in. He went into an unlocked door and kind of waited in a dark room and was just kind of having a paranoia fit. And he had brought a gun from home and was feeling like, you know, kind of like you feel like people are after you or what have you. And
he thought the Russian mafia was after him, right?
Yeah,
I mean, it was a delusion to the extent he thought.
Exactly.
A paranoia that someone was after him.
Absolutely. It was totally ungrounded. It had nothing to do with his reality at that time. But, you know, as Ken said, he was watching a football game on a blank TV. So, you know, so here you've got this 6'3", 300-pound man hiding in a dark space in a room before anything had opened in the building. And unfortunately, one of the employees had come in, you know, opened the door to the room he was in, flipped the lights, and he had, like many of us have, his extreme light sensitivity. The lights blasted him. He panicked and had fired a round. Thankfully, it hit her, you know, in the shoulder in a spot where she was actually released the same day. So that was the, you know, God moment that, you know, fortunately she was not, you know, critically wounded. And,
absolutely.
You know, he immediately upon the lights going on and once he could see that from the police report, his immediate response was, I'm so sorry, you didn't deserve that, you know, and something, you know, paraphrased about what you had mentioned with the mob stuff. He then had one of his friends meet him, and he actually sat there and waited for the police to pick him up on site. So, you know, he wasn't a, you know, as the media would portray, you know, a rabid, you know, killer or this or that or premeditated. I mean, he left in a paranoia, had not even ever really directly met this woman before. And, you know, this all came about because of his, you know, CTE type symptoms, which, you know, when you start going through what he was dealing with at the time, you know, with, you know, pre-dementia symptoms, he was having, you know, these extreme headaches. He ended up having a shunt put in because he had spinal fluid leaking into his brain cavity. So he had all that pressure going as well. And then he had, you know, the light sensitivity and a lot of these other symptoms that are prevalent with CTE, you know, that you put that all together. And the scary part is anybody that, you know, has been dealing with this knows that any one of us could really be one step away. And that's really where our relationship, I mean, I could see myself very easily trading spots with him if I had not acted, as you said, so as quickly with what I felt was going on, not feeling right. Whereas he took more of an approach of, you know, I just need to tough this out, you know, the football mentality. I just got to tough it out. I got to keep going to work. I got to keep getting better. Now, you know, his history, he had never had any trouble with the law. You know, he is a, you know, respectable citizen in Colorado where this all happened, you know, and prior to this, he had been on Mad Money with Kramer. He was very interested in the stock market. He had actually developed, through a, incubator company, a startup. He had started, a very successful company who had a product called Ice Black, which is, you know, the black that goes under the player's eyes that basically every kid now that plays, that's the first thing they want, even above their glove or their, you know, football or their helmet, is the, you know, the eye black under their eyes. You can't get it anywhere. You try to go to Dick's or anywhere, it's sold out. Well, that was his concept, and it did very well for him. So he was a very successful businessman. He went to Colorado University, very well educated, you know, business grad and so forth. And he also founded something interesting enough called Buffaloes for Life, where this organization provided financial support to any ex-athletes in crisis in need. So, you know, if it could be a track, you know, a track player, their wife was having chemo and they couldn't afford the bills, these angel donors would come in and just pay all the bills for them. And that was his foundation that he started, which is still in place there today. So he, somebody that had a background or any sort of character that represented what he was portrayed in court. And now the part that you'll really like, and this is kind of how things really, you know, the paths cross for a reason. The woman who, unfortunately was shot in the shoulder, she, is a wonderful person and has been very compassionate towards him and actually wants to see him get care and hopefully see a release in the future. But herself, you know, this is things that she's actually stated in the media and in the trial and so forth. But herself, she actually was a college athlete, and she had to hang it up early because of concussions. And so she understood what he was dealing with completely. So when he was explaining, you know, his condition and what was going on and the light sensitivity and the noise sensitivity and the what was, you know, an amygdala hijack in that situation, you know, she understood it. And that's really something that's pretty amazing. So, it's a very unfortunate situation, but the fact that you have such a compassionate victim who really thought about him and understood his context, I mean, it's pretty amazing to see that all develop and see her really understand that, you know, he was more, you know, like her, unfortunately, a victim of circumstance
than, you know, this intentional seeking her out, you know, kind of reckless, you know, shooting, you know, high on drugs or whatever other stuff was speculated. You know, unfortunately, mm-hmm. he did have the head pressure, and like many people that have this, you know, you go through various medications and prescriptions and supplements and sometimes alcohol, and sometimes you do use drugs on occasion to try to quell the pain, because it's, yeah, I've told people, it's like having somebody grip your head, like Shaquille O'Neal gripped your head like he's gripping a football. I mean, that the pain is that intense, and it's that focused. And so, you
right.
know, you add to that that he had, you know, the spinal fluid creating more pressure on his brain. You know, it's really amazing to me to hear it now that he went this long with the condition that he did. I mean, he started feeling the headaches in 2010, 2011-ish. So, you know, this incident happened in 2019. So he went, you know, almost 8 years dealing with this on a daily basis, and then, you know, unfortunately progressing in his symptoms. So, you know,
wait a minute. Now,
go ahead.
I'm sorry. I just wanted to interject, and correct me if I'm wrong. In my notes, I had that he played in the NFL for 9 years, so he definitely had the track record to have developed CTE in 9 years in the NFL playing with multiple teams, but he also received disability from NFL for physical injuries, as well as a separate full disability for brain injuries affirmed by an independent medical reviewer. Is that correct?
Yeah, so he actually played from 2002 to 2013. And, you know, he did, I think I had mentioned that he had some injuries from the league. He had five bodily injuries that when you get basically after your last year, you have a 5-year review based on what they call line of duty injuries. And unfortunately, he was denied at that time any sort of compensation when it's basically all the same injuries and things with, you know, the brain stuff, like you said, they keep the two separate. So, you know, apparently you only exist to your shoulders, but, you know, recently, he has received, you know, information about the other claims, going through the NFL's, the independent reviewers. So that does, in fact, you know, support, you know, that he very much has this neurological and degenerative condition that he's been dealing with.
But
and
that wasn't before the trial and the incident, though.
No, unfortunately,
that's
it was
now.
Not. That information was after that. And unfortunately, during the trial, there were a couple things that happened that were really unfortunate. The DA... you know, prosecuted him first degree with malicious intent, meaning, you know, basically he sought this woman out and waited and lied in wait for her and then shot her and had no remorse, you know, which is obviously not the case from what she has said in her own statements and from, you know, what has been shared of the context of it. So that was a really unfortunate situation because when it did go to trial, he, you know, was not able to speak about or obtain the records for his, you know, NFL time about concussions or CTE. So neither one of those were allowed to be presented. So, you know, as a group, unfortunately, it still has a very negative stigma. And if anything, there's not enough known about CTE with the general public. So in a case like this, as you said, it's used as an excuse. Oh, you're just throwing that out there. You know, you're just hoping that will get you off, so to speak. You know, he has, you know, worked with her on the civil side of this, and that's still ongoing. But, you know, there's been progress made with those things. And, you know, he
obviously would want the best for the victim. And she has, you know, actually made a statement when he, you know, was being sentenced, you know, to his benefit, you know, it's basically saying that she did not want to see him serve time. She wanted him to have an opportunity at, you know, rehabilitation and so forth, and get the help that he needed medically was one of the things that she emphasized. So, you know, when you have somebody, you know, sometimes, you know, one of the phrases within the CTE community, it takes CTE to know CTE, or a brain injury to know it. You know, like you guys talked in the last segment, we act different. We respond to things different. Sometimes we're in a bubble, even with our own family. Yet, two people that have it can totally understand each other. It's like we're speaking the exact same language. I could, you know, without knowing his symptoms, probably read off all of his symptoms and be just about spot on, you know, because of my own history with the progression and what they're now learning typically happens with this and how it kind of presents itself. So, you know, it's sad because he, you know, is, you know, he got 16 years, and I'm going to step out. This is my own statement, not anyone else's, but, you know, when you look at it, you look at the statutes in Colorado, you know, he should have been charged with third degree, which was basically a negligent discharge, you know.
Right.
Because first degree mm-hmm. means that he did something that would cause her critical harm, you know, and she didn't have a critical injury. He did negligently fire this off. A third degree means he would have been out in a year, you know, but instead he's dealing with 16 years. And the sad reality is, you know, with CTE and especially with his shunt, and the medical care that he needs that he can't get in the hospital, you know, it's most likely that, you know, he would never see the 16 years. He may not even see a year in jail with, you know, the lack of the supplements and other things that he needs, you know, on a regular basis. As you know from your own injury and myself, I mean, I have 13 to 14 different supplements I take a day. There's treatments I have to do. You know, and he's trying to deal with that with no access to any of those things, which, you know, also he has the anxiety and some of the other issues. So you can imagine being in an enclosed space with a lot of noise and bright light and everything else. It's really, if anything, going to trigger your symptoms.
Torture.
Make your decline faster. And
right.
That's really, you know, I just want people to understand that what you read in the headlines is not necessarily the full reality. It's just that it creates a story. It paints a picture. It gets clicks. It sells papers. But, you know, when you look at someone and you look at a deeper level and you look at their character and you look at what they've done for their community and the time – he didn't do these things after the fact. He was always doing these things. You know, it really helps paint a better picture of who this person is. And then it makes you understand that what happened on that fateful day is much more of an anomaly and so outside of the norm for him that it can't possibly be explained any other way.
Well, I hope someone else will pick up his story. I don't understand why some of that brain injury evidence wasn't allowed to be brought in. I know that most of the jury wouldn't have understood it. Some of them wouldn't have bought it. However, the criteria was certainly there for it to be a factor. So the fact that it couldn't be mentioned at all seems really unjust. The information should have been put out there and then people decide. It also helps raise awareness, but he was a textbook case, as you say. And then I agree with you, again, just my opinion on the charge, because when you're talking about intent, who knew who would be the first person in the building? So his intent would had to not been to shoot this woman, that I intend to shoot the first person who comes into the building. Well, I don't see that as being very viable. It'd be one thing if he was a mass shooter, some of the stuff we're seeing now, but we're seeing a guy in his own building. She happened to be the first one in, and it is a God wink. I don't understand the whole gravity of this picture right now, but the fact that the victim had suffered similar, experience with her sports and her concussions enough to be compassionate toward him. Wow, that's just...
Yeah.
I really hope that they take case.
Yeah, I mean, she's an amazing person, and the grace that she showed, I mean, it just takes an incredible ability to be outside of yourself, you know, to do something like that. But again, he truly is an amazing person, and you know, he has a young daughter, Isla, that he's a very good dad for, and you know, he. It would be a shame if he spent his last time on the planet rotting in a cell, when maybe he could be somebody that could help the NFL with diversion and with education and with guys seeing the signs and symptoms. Because as I told you, when the dark place hits, I mean, I was in a place where I was ready to drive off a bridge in just a matter of days. It happens very fast. Justin had 6 friends that died because of CTE. One of his best friend that he played with had the NFL settlement agreement on his table when he hung himself. So, you know, it's really something that hits. And, you know, Ken didn't talk about it, but Ken had 16 friends. He's buried as well because of this. So there is much more. And we owe it to these guys. As you said, I think the best way to sum it up is you talked about the family. Let's treat it like a family. Let's have both sides come to the table. Let's really care about these guys. Let's get them the help they need. Let's not call it mental illness and put it back on the guy to prove what's going on with them. Let's get them tested. Let's use the technology. Let's use the funds that the NFL and the NCAA have to give people the help that they need. And I think that's reasonable. You know, if you're going
to
make billions
dollars. Well, he's a lousy case to put,
he's
a lousy case to put up the mental illness with a shunt in his head. So,
yeah. Yeah.
That.
So.
Sorry to interrupt. I'm really blown away by the way that the case was handled. My thoughts and prayers are with Justin and his family. I hope that I hope he's able to get the appeal or the compassionate care release, because if anyone thinks he would be getting by unpunished, that is not the case. If people are listening, a lot of people do know what a shunt in the head is in this audience, but whether you do or you don't, it is punishment enough, and having a brain injury and a degenerative brain injury is punishment enough. And it seems like this case, based on what I've heard, you know, because he was anybody who is a celebrity, you know, have played in the NFL, been in show business, whatever it might be, that will build a better case. One of the things, you know, people like me would complain about is that because we're not one of those, our voices don't get heard. Well, when you are one of those people and you do something like what he did, often that's going to backfire and you're going to be sorry, or someone like me is going to be glad I'm not one of those people, that I'm one of those people whose voice isn't heard, because they were able to take this case, and it appears to me to not even let that information in was really a travesty. And
it
let
was,
and let the jury decide, you know, let the jury decide. Not that they're going to understand it, but you let a couple experts up there talk about his history, be able to demonstrate with witnesses the change, the dramatic change in his behavior. And then, you know, that brain shunt and that leakage had to come from, you know, you said the excess fluid. A lot of times that comes from swelling, but he definitely had a physical brain injury. He's not part of the invisible group that I'm in. This guy's got a shunt in his brain. So, you know, I don't know. The whole thing just really sounds like it stinks from the intent aspect to not letting in the evidence. Go on.
Yeah, and the fact that shunt, that being... You know, he's, unfortunately, he's a first-degree felon. So you're not in the low security, folks. You know, you're with some pretty bad people, and he's a celebrity. So that makes you high profile and makes you a target as well. And it literally would take one guy slapping him on the head to kill him. That's all it would take. And so for, you know, his own, you know, humane treatment and benefit, you know, I'm not, you know, I guess, you know, no one's asking for him to be completely absolved of the crime, including himself. But, you know, there does have to be some compassion to his care, to making sure that he's in a place that he's safe and that he can get treatments that keep him alive so he can actually serve his time. I mean, he's not even in a place where he could live through this, you know, I mean, honestly, maybe a year.
No, I understand. He didn't, you know, he got 16 years. He didn't get the death penalty, but unfortunately, that's kind of what it winds up being if it stands the way it is
right now. Right.
Wow. Well, again, my thoughts and prayers are with him and his family, and with everybody, with you, with Ken, with everybody out there suffering with CTE. And I so appreciate you and Ken, who dropped off, but I want to thank Ken Bertallo for being on, and Rico Petrini, you for being on again. I look forward to having you be back in the future. I appreciate all of the knowledge you've brought to us on the evolution of CTE, and it's so important for people to know, not only for things like this, you know, Justin's case, but when you said you could see yourself trading places with this person, anybody who's got a kid out now playing contact sports in Pop Warner, in junior high, in high school, you know, they're a step away from winding up in the same place. And this information just has to be out so that people can be aware. And the first ones to be aware are going to be the parents, because they're signing the releases when the kids are young. You know, later it's going to be up to the adult to make their decision based on the knowledge being out there, and we all make good and bad, not so good decisions, but that's going to be up to the adult when all the evidence is on the table for them to look at. But right now, in my opinion, and it's just my opinion, I'm not a doctor or an expert, just have heard a lot of stories in over 12 years, a lot of that big damage starts out much younger and escalates and accelerates as the time and the hits go on. So I appreciate you being here and all of the work that you've done and your willingness to spend the time here enlightening everyone. And
thanks to
Ken.
I really appreciate the opportunity.
All right. Well, thank you, Rico, and to everyone else, good night and God bless. I will see you again next Wednesday night. And I'm just going to close this out. The entire show is available on demand. We cut off a few minutes. We talked a little bit over the clock running out, so some people heard, some people got cut off. But the show is in its entirety on demand. So if you heard up to the last 15 minutes and you were cut off, you can click the link anywhere of the 30 places I posted it, or go to inaflash.org or braininjuryradio.com. Click the link, take the little time slider, drag it over to the right, and you can hear the last 15 minutes or listen to the whole show again. And if you've got friends or family members that are playing these contact sports, I encourage you to share these links and these shows with them, because the more we can help raise awareness and enlighten people to these truths that so many people don't want to know about because it interferes with their entertainment and it isn't about them. But you know what? It might be about their kids someday. And they need to know that. So, good night, everybody. This is Brain Injury Road. I'm going to close with Seems Apt by our network owner, as a matter of fact. You can find them at The R Insane, T-H-E-E, the letter R Insane, TheRInsane.com. Craig is a brain injury survivor and a very talented writer and musician, and this is in their final tour. Unfortunately, his longtime bandmate died of COVID a year ago, about a week. And so they did get their final albums cut. This is Brain Injury Road. Thank you, Rico, and good night, everybody. See you next week.
Back till I know I did my wondered at the world, don't care enough. Got drugs being used, kids so confused. Cause throughout their whole life, all they've seen is abuse. We've got countries fighting countries, people killing people. When are we gonna stop and realize everybody's equal? I don't know. But as far as I can tell, the rich are getting rich while the poor are needing help. So dig right down deep inside of your soul and find the peace, love and happiness to shine like gold in your mind. Feel so great, it's all you need to be, it's all you can, the best you can. And I know